This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from locally owned Spirit One Internet Services, offering reliable high-speed DSL, dial-up, web hosting, shell access, and more. For information, the number is 503-240-8200 or www.spiritone.com.
This song by Archie Shepp is in honor of Coretta Scott King.
Now is the time for all men to stand. Rise up, you starved and toiling masses. My brothers, sisters, all. We cannot fail. Justice is our avenging angel. All hail the birth of truth. Evil the blood from my brother's veins. How will we remember?
Okay.
Come soon that day when slaves break their chains.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a community memorial service will be held tonight to honor Coretta Scott King, civil rights leader and widow of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who died this week in her sleep.
Assistant U.S. Attorney John Houston told the panel in the Enron trial, this is not a case about accounting. It's about lies and choices.
Democrat Pete Sorensen has outlined a plan to eliminate the state's corporate income tax kicker.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,242 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,891 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 1st, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. The new chief executive of Scottish Power says the company is considering selling its orphaned U.S. power subsidiary, Portland-based PPM Energy, according to a report this week in London newspaper The Independent. PPM, formerly Pacific Core Power Marketing, comprises Scottish Power's non-regulated North American operations, primarily wind farms and natural gas storage facilities. The company is not part of the pending sale of Portland-based Pacific Core to Mid-American Energy Holdings Company, a transaction awaiting approval from utility regulators in six states. PPM has about 360 employees, including nearly 230 in Portland. PPM spokeswoman Jan Johnson emphasized that no decision on a sale had been made. PPM was last year's number two developer of wind power projects in the United States. In the last fiscal year, the company generated a net income of $98 million. Scottish Power agreed in May to sell Pacific Core to Mid-American, an effort by the UK company to begin closing the book on a troubled foray into U.S. energy markets.
Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling knew there was a ticking time bomb at Enron Corporation, but chose not to disclose the accounting problems that would eventually lead to the biggest business failure in history, a U.S. prosecutor said yesterday at the trial of the two former CEOs. A day after a jury of eight women and four men was seated, Assistant U.S. Attorney John Houston told the panel in his opening argument, this is not a case about accounting, it's about lies and choices. Houston said Lay and Skilling told lie after lie about Enron's finances and that they had key facts. With those facts, he said, they sold tens of millions of dollars of Enron stock. The two Enron executives face more than three dozen fraud and conspiracy charges, accusing them of lying to investors about the company's finances while they lined their own pockets by selling millions of dollars in stock. Enron filed for bankruptcy in December 2001 after investigators found it had used partnerships to conceal more than $1 billion in debt and inflate profits. The Houston-based company's collapse was the first of many high-profile scandals that eventually included WorldCom, Global Crossing, Adelphia, and Tyco International.
Dr. Peter Kohler, president of Oregon Health and Sciences University, said today that the healthcare system cannot cover everyone and curb costs at the same time without admitting its limits. Kohler outlined a broad proposal to test his hunch that a lower-cost approach based on less physician time and more on computer software could offer patients a better health payoff than traditional Medicaid. Kohler hopes to get private or public backers or both to help OHSU test the idea by trying it out on at least 5,000 Oregonians, selected from those who lost coverage under the Oregon Health Plan during the past 3 years. Care of this group often would not start with a doctor, but with a medical assistant backed by a team of nurses and doctors. Computer software based on scientific evidence would help guide the assistant. Care would emphasize preventative approaches, and priority would go to therapies known to improve health. To test the idea, those 5,000 patients would be matched with a similar group of 5,000 with traditional Medicaid coverage. Researchers would compare the health and medical outcomes of the two groups after 2 years or more.
The first lawsuit has been filed in connection with the theft of sensitive medical records from the vehicle of a Providence Health Systems supervisor. Lori Paul of Portland, in her class action lawsuit, filed Tuesday, alleged that Providence negligently put 365,000 people at risk. The lawsuit seeks a court order requiring Providence to arrange and pay for the credit monitoring of patients whose records were stolen and to pay for restoring potential damage to credit ratings. Attorney David Sugarman said Paul and others likely to join the case would also seek damages. Providence spokesman Gary Walker told the Oregonian that officials needed time to assess the claims. A thief smashed the window of a minivan parked at the Milwaukee home of a Providence Information Systems analyst who reported the theft December 31st. The thief took a laptop computer bag containing computer disks and data tapes. The records were not encrypted, according to Providence officials, who waited until January 25th to start notifying patients. Providence, after the break-in, started using encryption to protect backup files, which are now sent to an off-site location rather than to the homes of employees, Kagan said.
The Oregon Patient Safety Commission on Tuesday launched its efforts to get hospitals to report and reduce serious medical errors. The Oregon approach is a mix of voluntary and mandatory features. Hospitals can choose to participate or not, but refusal to join will be reported on the commission's website. Any hospital that does join will be required to report to the commission and to the affected patient or family any medical mistake that causes serious harm. Medical mistakes in U.S. hospitals kill 44,000 to 98,000 patients a year. This was found in a 1999 study by the Institute of Medicine. The 17-member commission unanimously adopted rules and guidelines for that process Tuesday in a three-hour meeting in Portland. Commissioner Chairman Dr. Glenn Rodriguez, who is a chief medical officer in Portland for Providence Health System, called the vote a milestone. He called the new rules a starting point. The Oregon Commission says it uses voluntary reporting because its members believe that doctors, nurses, and hospitals are more likely to disclose errors and share data if they can do so confidentially and without fear of penalty. Jim Damerson, the commission's administrator, said he hopes half of the state's 59 hospitals will be reporting by June and most or all of them by the end of the year.
Democrat Pete Sorensen, set to oppose Governor Ted Kulongoski in the May primary, yesterday outlined a plan to help Oregon community colleges by eliminating the state's corporate income tax kicker. Sorensen, a Lane County commissioner since 1997, told an audience at Lane Community College that ending income tax kicker for corporations could give the state $100 million per biennium for higher education. Oregon is the only state in the country with a kicker law. Businesses get their rebate in the form of a tax credit when corporate income tax collections in a two-year budget cycle come in at least 2% above the legislature's projections. Under Sorensen's plan, money retained by the state through elimination of the corporate kicker would be used to increase the state's community college budget to $500 million per biennium. The current biennial budget for those 17 schools is $434 million, less than they received from the state 5 years ago. Sorensen accused Kulongoski of not fighting for the state's community colleges since taking office in 2003. Officials with Kulongoski's office said the governor has not commented on eliminating the corporate income tax kicker.
An Oregon State University professor says he still believes the study by an OSU graduate student is flawed, so he will not stop fighting against it. Graduate student Daniel Donato concludes that leaving forests alone is the best way to help them recover from wildfires. It's a position opposed by John Sessions, a professor of forest engineering who supports logging and replanting. Sessions unsuccessfully tried to get the Journal of Science to avoid publishing research by Donato. Science editors said the journal's reviews are rigorous, and Donato's research was examined by two outside researchers. Reports authored by Sessions and others at OSU have been used to back a Bush administration plan to log areas burned by the 2002 Biscuit Fire and a bill to quicken logging of burned forests.
The Hood River News reports that State Representative Patty Smith, Republican of Corbett, is vowing to work on legislation to encourage the growth of renewable energy. Smith, chair of the Oregon House Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee, said she believes Oregon officials need to encourage more biomass, wind, hydro, and biodiesel production. The Hood River County Commission will interview candidates for a 9-member central steering committee to begin exploring green power options on February 21st. The local government agency believes that operating an alternative energy facility will provide revenue for extra projects such as a bicycle path along public rights of way throughout the area, more affordable housing opportunities for middle-income residents, and expanding the existing industrial land base to create more family-wage jobs. Smith said the House Committee intends to have an Oregon bill ready for introduction at the start of the 2007-2009 session. She is hopeful that legislation will spark more interest in renewable energy production.
The mass starvation deaths of murres on Tatoosh Island off the Olympic Peninsula may be due in part to unusual weather patterns along the West Coast, scientists say. In Washington, the state's largest colony of glaucous-winged gulls suffered when the normal fledge count plummeted from 8,000 chicks to 88 last year. Researchers also recorded low catches of juvenile salmon and rockfish, and there were sightings of emaciated gray whales. Also, a first appearance in Washington waters of thousands of squid, normally not found north of San Francisco. And a plankton typically found near San Diego bloomed along northwest beaches. Along the Washington and Oregon coasts, researchers believe that it was the lack of winds that led to the birds' deaths. In the spring, the Aleutian Low, a weather system that brings winter storms to the area, begins moving north. Winds push the surface of the Pacific Ocean to the southwest, allowing deeper, colder ocean water to surge in, bringing with it nutrients from dead plankton, dead fish, and fish excrement.
More information is coming out on plans for a Sandy River site for a proposed Oregon monument to Lewis and Clark, designed by internationally renowned architect Maya Lin. The Sandy River was visited by the Corps of Discovery in November 1805 and in April 1806. The proposed bicentennial monument is called the Confluence Project. Is a large curved bird blind atop a 10-foot by 15-foot elevated platform made of recycled cedar. It is scheduled for construction in Seattle this spring, then for public display at the Henry Art Gallery at the University of Washington. In the fall, the plan is to truck the monument to Troutdale and to place it at the eastern edge of the original mouth of the Sandy. Until now, the seven-site, $22.8 million confluence project has been focused on Washington State, which has so far ponied up most of its cost. The Washington legislature budgeted $7 million for the project during the past 2 years, and Governor Christine Gregoire's budget asks for $500,000 more. Also, the state's congressional delegation has directed thousands to the project. Confluence Project officials are now turning their attention to Oregon, where another project is envisioned west of the Dalles.
The current time is 5:13, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Attention, class. Once again, we have Congress to thank for teaching you kindergartners a lesson in moral behavior. The lesson is this, children. If you've been caught doing something naughty, the right thing to do is to deflect criticism from yourself by issuing a naughtiness reform package and scolding others for their bad behavior. Our ethics instructor in this case is Rick Santorum, a far right-wing senator from Pennsylvania. Rick has been caught leading a political effort in Washington to pass the agenda of corporate lobbyists in exchange for them delivering the bulk of their clients' campaign contributions to Republicans. He has held weekly closed-door meetings with top lobbyists to engage in this crass quid pro quo corruption. The insider deals between the corporate powers and the Republicans was given the code name of the K Street Project. Guess who else was involved with Rick in running it? The GOP's former majority leader, Tom DeLay, now known as Captain Corrupt, and Super Sleaze lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who recently pled guilty to paying off several Congress critters for legislative favors they did for his clients. So Santorum, who is now in a difficult race for re-election, has dressed himself up as the born-again Cape Crusader for congressional ethics reform. Incredibly, this poster child of the naughty entanglement of Congress and K Street is demanding moral purity from others and, like a street preacher, loudly touting political redemption through a legislative package to restrict the influence that those bad old lobbyists have on lawmakers. Curiously, when Democrats proposed this same reform package last year, Santorum showed no interest in it at all. This is Jim Hightower saying, did I mention that Rick the Reformer also happens to have received more campaign money from lobbyists in this election cycle than any other member of Congress? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6, here's Circle A Radio. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, as you would expect, showers after midnight, lows 40 to 45, and then tomorrow, more showers with highs around 50. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Cornvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
There will be an ecumenical community memorial service tonight to honor Coretta Scott King, a civil rights leader and the widow of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who died this week in her sleep. The service will be at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church in Portland at 3138 North Vancouver Avenue. Speakers will also include T. Allen Bethel, president of Albina Ministerial Alliance, and Senator Margaret Carter. Members of various religious communities, including communities of the Catholic, Jewish, and Muslim faiths, will share reflections on King, and audience members will be invited to do so as well.
Oregonians donated a record $2.32 million to the Oregon Cultural Trust in 2005, 16% more than they donated in 2004, Governor Ted Kulongoski said on Tuesday. It represented an increase of more than $360,000. The legislature approved Oregon's cultural tax credit in 2001. Nearly 4,500 residents contributed to the trust in 2005, an increase of 14%. Increases were particularly noted in coastal communities and in southern Oregon, where new immigration from California is heavy. 58% of the money raised by the Cultural Trust goes into permanent endowments to support Oregon's heritage, humanities, and the arts. The remaining 42% is distributed annually through competitive grants to Oregon's cultural nonprofits, to county and tribal cultural coalitions, and to Oregon's statewide cultural partner agencies. The trust distributed more than $1.2 million in grants statewide in 2005.
The Columbia newspaper in Vancouver yesterday carried an interview with Washington State Representative Jim Moeller, speaking out against activist Tim Eymann's new anti-gay ballot initiative, filed on Monday. The new initiative is a departure for Eymann, who is known for his tax limitation campaigns. Moeller, one of four openly gay men serving in the Washington State Legislature, charges that Ayman is not only out to make a personal financial profit from the new ballot measure. According to the Colombian, Mueller opposes asking voters to ratify the action the House and Senate took Friday when they passed a law making it illegal to discriminate in housing, employment, credit, and insurance based on sexual orientation. Governor Christine Gregoire signed the bill yesterday. Mueller told the Colombian it was Oregon's anti-gay rights Measure 9, defeated in 1992, that made him decide to enter politics. Oregon voters defeated a second anti-gay rights measure in 1994 by a slightly narrower margin.
The only woman in the Democratic race for Oregon governor bowed out today when State Senator Vicky Walker said she instead will try to keep her Senate seat. Her departure leaves only two announced candidates in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, incumbent Governor Ted Kulongoski and Lane County Commissioner Pete Sorensen. Former State Treasurer Jim Hill has said in the past that he is considering running, but has made no formal statements about his plans. Walker hinted that Hill or another Democrat may soon step forward. She said she has talked to Hill, but would not elaborate. Walker faces an energetic challenge to her Senate seat by former Eugene Mayor Jim Torrey. Torrey has been raising campaign money while Walker contemplated her possible run for governor.
The Albany Democratic Herald this week is praising Oregon's only public military alternative high school for providing services to kids who wash out of more traditional schools. According to the Democrat Herald, military recruiter Joel Garibay was in Albany on Tuesday to promote the Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program. It has operated since 1994 in a former Department of Defense satellite tracking station in the desert, 20 miles east of Bend. Called Cadets, the students can earn 8 or more high school credits that could lead to a high school diploma or a general education development diploma. The only cost to a parent is about $300 needed to buy their children's toiletries, boots, gym shoes, and incidentals. Garibay told a reporter, the cost per student is picked up by the federal and state governments. Oregon requires that 100 cadets graduate per session to continue to receive funding. Usually about 110 students graduate. As of January 14th, there were 131 students in this program.
The Snohomish County, Washington Business Journal reports that Mervyn's will close its store throughout Washington State by early next year to improve the corporation's overall profits. The chain is also closing 6 stores in Oregon and 1 in Salt Lake City. Altogether, the closures will mean the loss of 1,400 part-time and full-time jobs, including 880 across Washington. The struggling department store chain has occupied a 117,000-square-foot anchor space at Washington's Everett Mall since 1992. The corporate owner of the mall, Steadfast Companies, began planning last year for the store's closure. Management said, quote, we are not surprised by the announcement. We anticipated this very thing happening.
Walmart and its local opponents are getting ready for the next round after the initial decision went against the retail giant's proposal for a store in fast-growing Bend. Hearing officer Karen Green has decided that Walmart failed to prove it could accommodate the 12,000 extra car trips per day the store was estimated to generate. She called it an enormous amount of additional traffic. Walmart announced plans almost a year ago to build one of its supercenters on 20 acres in Northeast Bend, generating opposition from Bend residents who held rallies, showed movies, and placed signs in their front lawns in protest of the store. The group said Walmart's traffic study contained serious errors and the proposed mitigation plan did not meet state standards. An appeal would go to the Bend City Council, which could hear it or send it on to the State Land Use Board of Appeals. If the council hears it, an appeal could continue to the state board. Green's denial followed several other cases in Oregon in which cities have said no to Walmart. Hood River's denial was supported by the Oregon's Court of Appeals, while denials in Central Point and Medford have been appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. The city of Gresham has also denied a Walmart application, causing the company to submit plans for a smaller store.
An industry-funded study says wine has become a billion-dollar business in Oregon. The Oregon Wine Board released a report that says the economic impact of the wine business and related activities was $1.4 billion in 2004. That includes the value of winery revenues, retail wine sales, the value of related businesses such as vineyard maintenance and distribution, tourism, and a range of sales rung up by supporting industries. In recent years, the board have cited a figure of $100 million for the economic impact of its businesses. The $1.4 billion figure released yesterday came from a report commissioned by the industry group and conducted by Full Glass Research of Berkeley, California. The $1.4 billion includes retail wine sales. Without those, the direct economic impact of the state's wine industry is at $801 million, the study said. The study may be a debating point in the future in land use battles between the wine business and developers.
A search warrant has been served in the small southern Oregon town of Riddle after undercover narcotics officers brought 1/4 pound of marijuana from a 32-year-old man. In addition to selling marijuana, officers determined that the residents on Council Creek Road were in possession of substantially more dried marijuana than is authorized by the Oregon State Department of Human Services Medical Marijuana Program. Marcus Vaughn Frickson and 50-year-old Susan Mary Beck have both been arrested and charged with unlawful delivery and possession of marijuana. The narcotics team say they also found 3 plastic containers filled with 39 pounds of dried marijuana, a dozen growing plants, and 30 glass jars containing marijuana bud. Detectives also found 2 sets of scales and more than $7,000 in cash.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 1st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editor is Rabia Yeaman. Special thanks to reporter Stephanie Potter. Our engineer is Eduardo Delanderos-Tierre. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Sheffi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's Joanne Bowman and Dave Maza hosting Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. The topic is police accountability 1 year later. And the guest is Marlene Howell, coordinator of Alliance for Police and Community Accountability. At the beginning of the show, hear about the case of Daryl Hunt. He was released from a lifetime prison sentence after DNA evidence exonerated him. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's part 2 of the World Trade Center Destruction, a lecture by David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor and other books. At 7:30, Julie Bernard hosts Art Focus with guests from the Maverick Exhibition at the Mark Woolley Gallery, artists George Johansson, William Park, and Melinda Torsnes. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us, and have a good evening.
He's here with us forever now.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 1st of February, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Democrats and protesters weigh in on President Bush's State of the Union address. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin is in Washington today calling Hurricane Katrina a man-made disaster. And Subcomandante Marcos speaks with FSRN. We'll bring you the first part in a series of the exclusive one-on-one interview. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The American Civil Liberties Union and its local affiliates filed multiple Freedom of Information Act requests today in an effort to uncover why the Pentagon has been monitoring the activities of anti-war groups and pacifist organizations. The FOIA requests were filed on behalf of Veterans for Peace, the American Friends Service Committee, Greenpeace, and dozens of local organizations in seven states. Meanwhile, privacy rights group the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a class action lawsuit against AT&T yesterday, saying the telecommunications giant violated the law and the privacy of its clients by complying with the National Security Agency's request to access massive amounts of data as part of an illegal surveillance program. The class action lawsuit filed on behalf of a group of AT&T customers alleges that AT&T gave the NSA direct access to databases and key telecommunications facilities. The EFF calls the NSA's warrantless wiretapping and data mining operation the largest phishing expedition ever devised. The legal challenge is based on the First and Fourth Amendments, as well as on federal electronic surveillance and telecommunications statutes. AT&T has 30 days to act on the complaint. The Connecticut chapter of the NAACP filed a motion this week to intervene in a lawsuit filed by the state against the Department of Education over requirements in the No Child Left Behind Act. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Connecticut is challenging certain provisions of the No Child Left Behind statute, specifically the testing provision, as an unfunded mandate that it should not be required to meet without additional federal funding. A lawyer for the NAACP says it acted in order to prevent the state from creating a legal defense that it doesn't have to comply with a federal statute on those grounds. NAACP attorney John Britton says the civil rights organization has sided with the federal government and asked to be a party to the suit because ending the annual assessments would be harmful to low-income and minority students.
When two giants are involved in litigation, the voices of the minority students need to be heard, and that's why the NAACP wants a seat at the table. Connecticut, the richest state in the nation, has the worst achievement gap between poor and non-poor students. It has three of the most racially isolated cities.
The federal judge in the case has not yet set a hearing date on the NAACP's motion. In New Haven, Connecticut, I'm Melinda Tuhus for FSRN.
Representatives from 70 nations have gathered in London to map out a blueprint for the future of Afghanistan. Helen Kelly reports.
The five-year plan, dubbed the Afghanistan Compact, will replace the deal reached at a December 2001 conference in Bonn, Germany. In the new document, Afghanistan undertakes to disarm illegal militias, guard human rights, cut poverty, and tackle the opium trade through a development program for farmers and local communities. International donors vow to provide ongoing support in the form of NATO-led peacekeeping forces. Cash pledges have also been made. UK Prime Minister Tony Blair promised £500 million in aid, while US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice offered $1.1 billion. Russia will wipe out Afghanistan's $10 billion Soviet-era debt. But UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan, who also attended the meeting, urged caution in the emerging Afghan democracy, which has much to achieve to pull its people out of widespread poverty. Helen Kelly, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Airport workers in India have launched an indefinite strike against a government plan to privatize the country's two largest airports. From New Delhi, Vinod Kijos reports.
The Indian government announced on Tuesday that two Indian firms and their foreign associates won the bid to privatize Delhi and Mumbai airports. Soon after the Indian cabinet gave its approval for privatization today, thousands of airport workers launched a nationwide strike. In Mumbai, riot police caned hundreds of protesting workers. Air traffic at the country's busiest airports was not disturbed by the strike today. Opponents of the privatization plan say it will lead to the cuts in the workforce. In the past, following a socialist model, Indian government controlled most industries and service sectors, including airports and railways. But for the last 15 years, government opened its market for private players. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for FSRN.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush is touring the country today to promote the initiatives he presented in his State of the Union address, although the speech provided few new ideas. Bush instead reiterated familiar themes regarding the ongoing war in Iraq and national security, and also reintroduced initiatives to curb the rising cost of health care and decrease U.S. dependency on foreign oil. But, as Leanne Caldwell reports, most Democrats responded by saying Bush's words were full of empty promises, while protesters demonstrated outside.
The first half of the president's sixth annual address to the nation was spent on international policy.
At the start of 2006, more than half the people of our world live in democratic nations. And we do not forget the other half, in places like Syria, in Burma, Zimbabwe, North Korea, in Iran.
Democratic Representative Charles Rangel from New York.
Who's going to fight all of these wars to bring democracies? We don't have a draft. We don't have congressional kids or affluent kids there. When now he says the military option's on the table with Iran, and I suspect with Syria, I suspect with North Korea, and all of the other countries that the president wants to bring free elections and freedom to.
Representative Rangel plans to reintroduce his bill this year to bring back the draft. Then he transitioned to domestic issues.
Tax relief is set to expire in the next few years. If we do nothing, American families will face a massive tax increase they do not expect and will not welcome.
Representative Melvin Watt from North Carolina and leader of the Congressional Black Caucus.
These massive tax cuts that have disproportionately benefited the wealthiest people have left us into very, very serious deficit spending. And now his right wing is saying, well, you can't spend any money on anything.
He did speak a lot about making the tax cuts for the rich permanent, but he didn't say how much money we'll have to borrow from China in order to pay for it.
That was Representative Rangel. In December, Secretary of the Treasury Jack Snow asked Congress to raise the debt ceiling limit from $8 trillion immediately. In his letter, he said the government does not have the resources to pay for programs beyond mid-March. The Senate began debating permanent tax cuts today. Turning back to the president's speech, he then transitioned to Social Security reform.
Congress did not act last year on my proposal to save Social Security.
Those were Democrats in the caucus applauding his defeat.
Keeping America competitive requires affordable energy. And here we have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world.
Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey, the newest member of the Senate.
We heard him talk about renewable energy sources, but it's a little late when you gave the oil and gas industry $15 billion in tax benefits, and you talk about giving renewable sources about $260 million. That's about 50-1.
Tonight I announced an American Competitiveness Initiative to encourage innovation throughout our economy and to give our nation's children a firm grounding in math and science.
Representative Jerry Nadler from New York.
He has cut the budget for funding scientists by about 50% since he's been in office.
The president also urged Congress to take up his health savings accounts, which critics say cost the government too much and disproportionately benefit the wealthy. Meanwhile, hundreds of protesters stood outside rejecting all Bush administration policies. Ann Wright, former Foreign Service official.
We have got to get this administration out of here. So we have got to get the Congress ready to go for investigations for articles of impeachment and impeach the Bush administration.
The president traveled to Tennessee today to promote his plans. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin testified before the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee today. He called Hurricane Katrina a man-made disaster and says much of the devastation could have been avoided had the state and federal government understood the emergency better. Yan Mei Shea has more from Capitol Hill.
The levee at New Orleans' Ninth Ward broke shortly after Katrina made landfall. Nagin says for years the federal government had shortchanged the city's efforts to strengthen the levee system, despite his persistent lobbying.
It's never enough money
that we need. It just seems to be part of the process. Unfortunately, the levees in New Orleans never really were understood as far as how critical they are, and it was didn't seem to be the political will to spend the money to do it right.
After the levee failed, tens of thousands were stranded in New Orleans Convention Center for days without basic supply. Megan says, in the midst of desperation, he was stunned by what he saw at FEMA staging area, right outside of the city.
It was like the Ritz-Carlton at the field. They had water, they had ice, they had everything you could pop. They even had doggone watermelons on the counters.
Mm-hmm.
And our people were down in the city, eating MREs.
4 days after the city was flooded, President Bush met with Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco and Mayor Nagin in New Orleans. Nagin says he was frustrated by, quote, an incredible dance between the federal government and the state government on who's in charge.
In the midst of all the rhetoric that was going on around the table, I stopped everyone and basically said, Mr. President, Madam Governor, if the two of you don't get together on this issue, more people are going to die in this city, and you need to resolve this immediately.
According to Nagin, no decision emerged from the meeting on who had the final authority. Meanwhile, Nagin continues to request more federal assistance to support New Orleans' rebuilding efforts. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News at Capitol Hill.
Zapatista Subcomandante Marcos, now known as Delegate Zero, continues to travel through Mexico, listening to local communities as part of the Other campaign. In this exclusive one-on-one interview conducted at the Center for the Documentation of Son Jarocho in Jaltipan, Veracruz, I spoke with Marcos about the timing of the Other campaign, the shift towards the so-called political left in Latin America, the representation of women, and more. So why the Other campaign now for 2005 and 2006?
Well, because we as Zapatistas had to endure a process of preparation, like the uprising in 1994, where we prepared for 10 years to realize it. We also had to do a process of preparation. The Other campaign was actually born in 2001, when Mexico's three political parties, the PRI, the PAN, and the PRD, denied the Cucopa Initiative for Indigenous Cultural Rights. So it was at this point that we evaluated that the path with the Mexican political class was exhausted, that we had to find another path. The options were war, going back to fighting, or to stay quiet in silence and wait to see what would happen, or to do what it is that we're doing now. When we decided that we had to prepare for this possibility, we started to prepare ourselves because it was very likely that people who had supported us up until that point for Indigenous cultural rights would take back their support at the hour we took distance from the political parties, especially from the so-called institutional left, the PRD.
Pero también al mismo tiempo teníamos que prepararnos para un golpe quirúrgico, un golpe del ejército.
But at the same time, we had to prepare ourselves for a surgical strike, a strike from the military or from the police, under any pretext that would behead and leave the EZLN without direction.
Para nosotros, la iniciativa de la sexta declaración.
For us, the initiative of the Sixth Declaration is of the same magnitude, or maybe even greater, than the Declaration of War in 1994. And we had to be prepared to lose the entire leadership, because according to our method, at the same time that we said to do something, we have to put those leaders in front to set the example. So in this case, we had to be ready to lose not only Marcos, but all of the non-leadership, who are the ones that will be going out to do the political work. The comandantes, like Comandante Esther, Comandante Tacho, Comandante David, Comandante Cebedeo. The alien Comandante Ramona was also going to come out, but unfortunately, Comandante Susana, all of us who were more or less publicly known were going to come out. So we had to prepare for that, and we had to make plans for the first exploratory tour, which has fallen on me, which we are doing now.
Ahorita estamos en Veracruz, en el sur de Veracruz.
Right now we're in Veracruz, in southern Veracruz. And in case that something were to happen,
no se pierda nada de lo que hemos logrado hasta ahora, o podamos
let nothing of what we've gained so far be lost, or be able to defend it as much as possible.
No pudo haber sido antes, ni no podía ser después.
It could not have been before, and it could not have been after, because if we were already prepared, there was no need to wait longer to do it.
Escogimos precisamente el periodo electoral para que quedara claro que
specifically chose the electoral period so that it was clear that we wanted to do something else, and so people could really see
nuestra propuesta
compare and contrast our political proposal,
muchos que se han sumado,
to which already many have joined
personas,
from other organizations,
groups,
and people who could not before compare and contrast it with politics from the top.
Siempre desde nuestro nacimiento hemos insistido en esto de otra forma de hacer política.
Always since our birth, we've insisted in this other way of doing politics. Now we have the chance to do it without arms, but without stopping being zapatistas. That's why we keep the mask on.
We caught up with Subcomandante Marcos at the Center for the Documentation of Son Jarocho in southern Veracruz. Tune into tomorrow's newscast for part two of our exclusive one-on-one interview. In December of 2005, Initiative 901 was passed into law by Washington State voters, amending the Washington Clean Air Act of 1985, adding additional designation of public places where smoking is banned. However, as the law now stands, it does not provide for exemption of ceremonial use of smoke in public places and may be seen as unconstitutional by those who burn plant materials for religious purposes, especially affecting Native Americans residing and practicing in Washington State. Robin Carnine has more.
Storm Reyes, a Puyallup tribal member and an Eagle Lodge minister, burns sage, cedar, and tobacco for prayer, both personally and during public ceremonies. She admits she voted for I-901, not realizing that it would take away tribal members' First Amendment rights. The type of prayer she and others practice is called smudging, and it is used for specific occasions. After the law passed, she was told by the Tacoma Pierce County Health Department that a permit was required to use smoke in public places, and without one, she and others could be fined. Alarmed, Reyes spoke to the ACLU, who advised her and others to seek legal exemption, not specified in the 1985 Clean Air Act and the new I-901 law.
We're not asking to do anything differently than we've done before. Hold our weddings, hold our funerals, our blessings, our naming ceremonies, powwows, and for it not to be considered criminal behavior.
Last week in Olympia, Washington, Reyes and several others testified at a public hearing in support of SB 6213, a new bill that Senator Rogala and other representatives have sponsored, which, if passed, will amend I-901. During Rogala's testimony to the Senate Committee on Labor, Commerce, Research, and Development, she said the proposed bill will recognize the constitutional principle of religious practices, so that someone who uses smoke in a sacred ceremony as part of a religious practice, as part of a established religion, would not be violating this initiative in the current state law. Sponsor of I-901, Dr. Chris Covert-Bolds of Ferndale, Washington, testified in opposition, stating his concerns of the redefinition provided through the new proposed bill of what is public place and employment.
If this were passed, it would permit unlimited cigarette and cigar smoking in any restaurant or bar or business or any building, public place or school office building, as long as it could be claimed that a religious ceremony was happening somewhere in the location. You burn some incense in the back room, or even if you said my bar where people come to drink, that's my religion.
Several other states do have similar smoking bans, but with specific exceptions that legally address and ensure the religious rights of those wishing to create and use smoke in a ceremonial fashion without fear of violating the law. This is Robin Carnine in Washington State.
11 people were indicted last week in connection with a series of arsons that took place from 1996 to 2001. The fires, the majority of which took place in Oregon, were attributed to the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. FSRN's Julie Sabatier reports from Portland.
A grand jury in Eugene, Oregon, has indicted 11 individuals on 65 counts of arson and conspiracy in 17 separate incidents. The people named in the indictment are said to be affiliated with the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, which the FBI has called the greatest threat of domestic terrorism in the United States.
Now, the term domestic terrorist and terrorism, in my opinion, is really a sensationalist exaggeration.
That's Lauren Regan. She's a lawyer and executive director for the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene.
No one was ever harmed. There was no intention to harm human life. You know, this is property damage. You know, arson is a serious charge, but it's a property crime. And to compare these people to, you know, people who flew planes into buildings seems ludicrous to many, many Americans, I think, watching these cases unfold.
The indictment, which was recently unsealed in Portland, names Chelsea Gerlach, Stanislaus Meyerhoff, Jonathan Paul, Darren Thurston, Kevin Tubbs, and Suzanne Savoy, all of whom are currently in custody. Savoy turned herself in shortly after the indictment. Daniel McGowan and Sarah Harvey, also named in the 83-page document, have been released on bail. Three others, Rebecca Rubin, Joseph Dibe, and Josephine Overraker, remain at large. William Rogers is listed as an unindicted co-conspirator. He died in an apparent suicide while in custody at an Arizona jail this past December. Each count in the indictment also makes reference to others known or unknown to the grand jury. The unnamed persons are thought to be informants, or people involved in the arsons who are cooperating with the government in exchange for leniency.
Informants is a kind of a loaded term. It can mean different things to different people.
Assistant U.S. Attorney for Oregon, Stephen Pfeiffer, is one of three federal prosecutors involved in the case.
I think it's been made very clear in open court and in court documents that this case depends upon a number of cooperating individuals, and I wouldn't want to characterize them all as informants.
Writer and activist Michael Donnelly has a different point of view.
I think once the whole truth comes out in this, we'll find out that government agents were in on every single one of these incidents. My suspicion is that the government sent agent provocateurs out who have been out trying to recruit idealistic, young, naive people to carry out acts that will get them in trouble and cause discredit to the movement.
Regan says it is too early to speculate about government involvement, but she questions the motivations of those who have chosen to cooperate in this case.
Obviously, when someone is facing life in prison, there is quite an incentive for them to cooperate with the government and provide them with any information that the government might want. And so there is a jury instruction that says that that type of testimony should be treated with distrust because there is just this extreme motivation to lie. And so, you know, it will be interesting to see, you know, how that will play out.
Again, Stephen Pfeiffer.
This is the result of a long investigation that's been going on for roughly 9 years. It's not unlike many very complex white-collar cases that involve huge amounts of documents and other material that it takes time to digest and prepare.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Today marks the one-year anniversary in Nepal of King Gyanendra's dismissal of government and imposition of a state of emergency, which stretched through April. While the king ostensibly took control of the government in order to deal more effectively with the country's decade-long Maoist insurgency, the last year in Nepal has been mired in conflict with an alarming decrease in civil liberties. In addition, the royal regime has called for municipal elections for February 8, which many voters will be boycotting. On Monday, one mayoral candidate was shot in the Kathmandu Valley. FSRN's Carrie Byron has more.
Nepalis are calling February 1st Black Day. It was 1 year ago at 10 in the morning that King Gyanendra addressed the nation, announcing that he was dismissing the prime minister and assuming executive authority himself. Immediately after the proclamation, all communication networks were cut off and a state of emergency was imposed. At the time, the king acted in response to the strengthening Maoist forces in the countryside. 9 months later, however, in mid-November, the Maoists and the dismissed political parties signed a loose agreement. Hari Sharma is director of the social science Baha.
So the Maoists are waging war from jungles, and the political parties waging their struggle for the peaceful democratic transitions. Both agitating groups agree that the new Nepal that would be created after the struggle would be radically different from what we have right now.
The main motivating factor behind the November agreement, he says, was the king's announcement of municipal elections to be held in early February.
So on this particular issue, both Maoist and the political parties came together because they don't want municipal elections to be held at this time until and unless the larger political question, that where the question like sovereignty of people, the peaceful resolutions of the conflict that is going on.
Now, much of civil society has joined these groups, leading to increasingly large public demonstrations around the country. In mid-January, 150,000 people turned out to protest in southeastern Nepal. When a similar demonstration was scheduled for Kathmandu days later, the government banned public gatherings larger than 10 people within the capital limits and imposed a full-day curfew for the scheduled day. 5 days later, the ban was lifted and protesters returned to the streets.
No. This is our continuous program, yeah. We will continue this program until the government will...
But even with the lifting of the ban and after a week of international condemnation, riot cops moved in on protesters within the rally's first minutes, armed with sticks, bricks, tear gas, dummy bullets, water cannons, and excessive force. Days later, live ammunition was used on demonstrators in west central Nepal. More than anything else, protesters explained, those in and out of Nepal need to understand that elections do not mean democracy.
This is not the election. What do you mean by the election? First of all, I want to ask to all of the people.
Rajendra Banya is a member of one of the agitating political parties.
An election means there must be the participation of the people. And those parties who have got more than 90% of the vote in the last election, they are not participating in it. They are not going to support the king's movement here.
Far from participating, Nepal's major parties are actively working against the elections. Last Thursday, on the final day for candidates to file for the election, the political parties called for a countrywide shutdown. More than half of municipal seats remain without candidates. On Monday, the Elections Commission announced that 22 out of the 58 municipalities won't even hold elections because single candidates were declared unopposed winners. Almost 650 additional candidates have subsequently withdrawn from the elections, some even after being declared victorious, claiming either to fear for their safety or that they were tricked by government officials into running in the first place.
Actually, King is confused and he's trying to confuse Nepalese people as well as the international community. And he has defined democracy in his own way.
Pacho Chapagai is a Kathmandu teacher.
And now he's trying to elect his S-men. And after election, he can complain that he's more democratic than political leaders.
Chapagai says that if valid elections were held next week, he doubts the king would receive hardly any votes.
Nepalese are in favor of either political parties or Maoist. I think about 5% people support king.
After the political parties and the king traded curfews in recent weeks, the Maoists have now called for a shutdown of a week or longer, perhaps starting as soon as February 2nd and stretching past the February 8th elections. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Carrie Byron in Kathmandu.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective produced out of Pacifica stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team includes Jay Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. I'm Aura Bogado. Thanks for listening.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 1st of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A bill to increase home ownership on reservations in South Dakota has cleared one chamber of the state legislature despite opposition. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Johanna Saylor reports.
House floor discussion became heated over a bill that would allow tribal housing agencies to purchase homes from the state-run Governor's House program. Democratic Representative Margaret Gillespie says tribal agencies on reservations should be able to help the poorest South Dakotans.
Why can't we have someone who doesn't even make $30,000 or $20,000 or $10,000 the chance to have one of these houses? This is absurd. And if you intend to vote against this, then I ask you, what's wrong with you? What are you thinking?
South Dakota's prison inmates build the houses that are sold for $33,000 to low-income individuals. Opponents of the measure say expanding the program will take further business away from private contractors and that the homes are to be purchased by the homeowner, not a nonprofit agency like a tribal housing authority. But supporters say many Native Americans on South Dakota's poverty-stricken reservations cannot afford even the discounted homes without assistance. The bill passed 56-14. I'm Johanna Saylor, Pierce, South Dakota.
The American Dental Association is suing to stop the dental health therapist program in rural Alaska. The therapists provide cleanings and teach prevention, but they can also pull teeth and fill cavities, which some dentists oppose. Alaska Public Radio Network's Annie Feit reports.
American Dental Association President Robert Brangert says the ADA wants the therapist to continue cleaning teeth, but he says only licensed dentists should be allowed to perform more complicated procedures.
We believe that Alaskan Natives are being placed in risk unfairly and unnecessarily by non-dentists doing irreversible dental surgical procedures.
There are currently 8 dental therapists practicing in rural Alaska. Dentist Edwin Algar oversees dental health therapists for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, or YKHC, in Bethel. He says the therapists were surprised to learn that they were the target of a lawsuit, but they'll keep practicing.
YKHC will continue to use legal activities to provide care for the people who don't have dental care. At this point, we've been told that the therapists here are legal and used in the federal program by tribal health organization, and will continue to do so until they're not legal anymore. If they become illegal, then we'll stop.
Officials with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium say they're reviewing the lawsuit and will decide how to proceed in the next 30 days. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Even as the controversy turns legal over the wisdom of dental health aid therapists in rural Alaska, newly minted DHATs are returning from study abroad and preparing to practice in their communities. Paul Korchin from KNOM in Nome has more.
Aurora Johnson and Tammy Galagergan recently came back to Western Alaska, having spent 2 years studying in New Zealand, where dental health aid therapists have been used since the 1920s. Johnson characterized their professional training as full-on.
It's not like a regular university where you have, one day you're going to have anatomy, maybe, and next day, you know, like 2 hours of school or 3 hours. It's nothing like that. It's 5 days a week, you know, 8:30 to 5.
Opponents of DHATs argue they're not competent to perform dental procedures like drilling and extracting teeth. But Johnson and Galagergan say their education has consistently reinforced the boundaries.
The scope of practice is everything that we've been working on for 2 years, and everything that's not in our scope of practice. You know, our tutors have always taught us to refer. Mm-hmm.
Galagergan is already a dental assistant. She grew up in Nome, but plans to return to her ancestral community after even more training at the Regional Health Corporation.
Where I'm going to be based in St. Lawrence Island, you know, I really feel that they need my help because, you know, we go there and sometimes things aren't the greatest, but I hope to turn things around and, you know, open their eyes to prevention.
As for Johnson, she plans to go home to Unalakleet.
Once we are ingrained in our positions and the community knows us and trusts us, then it's going to be successful. This is a way to do it because we're not going to leave our communities.
More new DHATs are expected to return to Alaska next year. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.